Welcome one and all, my name is Alexander, and you are listening to a Realization Special. I always like to start off grand topics like this from the most important branch of philosophy, which is epistemology, which goes after the foundation for everything we know. How do we know what we know? What has been the foundation for the buildings that we've built thus far? And if we approach the things we've learned all our lives from that root, we can come to understand that most of the consensual things we've learned thus far are literally and figuratively fundamentally flawed in terms of logic. You could say that many of them don't have any feet to stand on, which tangentially brings back the importance of a solid foundation. During my quest for the truth about health, I have spent enormous amounts of time and attention to read through all of the material that serves as the apparent proof that disease is an external threat that can be induced by external entities. However, after taking an unbiased and open look at this apparent proof, which serves as the foundation for our knowledge about health and disease, I have discovered many great flaws in the thesis of contagion and immunity. To keep it all concise, the thing that triggered me the most is the interpretation of a, quote, contagion, which stems mostly from in vitro experiments, which are studies that are done on a sample that is taken out of the living human body, a sample that is removed from its natural environment. The sample was once an integral part of an intact living structure, but now it is removed. So it is in fact not living anymore. It is now dead. The things you see in front of you in a tissue sample represent nothing more than dead, rotting material. And this becomes even more blatant if you understand that a tissue sample has to undergo many dubious preparation methods before it is viewed under an electron microscope, in the case of, quote, viruses. The conclusions that are drawn about the thesis of contagion and immunity stem mostly from the erroneous viewpoint that the things you see in a rotten poison tissue sample, after it has been fixed with formaldehyde, stained with salts of heavy metals, and bombarded by electron beams, under very strict laboratory conditions, in vitro, can be extrapolated to the actual living human body, in vivo. And I beg to differ wholeheartedly, as I've explained in my video called What is a Virus?, from whence I go through each of the preparation methods individually and respectively, in order to give the listener an understanding of how far the materials they study deviate from what it originally was. And logically, no conclusions can be made from such a heavily edited tissue sample, from whence no extrapolations can be made to the living human body. To be quite frank, substances like formalin, ethanol, paraffin wax, urinal acetate, and lead citrate don't belong in a living human body. So in vitro and in vivo drastically differ, more than science has established as of yet, which has a reason to it. So I have made it clear that the idea of viral contagion has no feet to stand on, as well as contagion by bacteria, which I encourage you to watch as well. And now, it is time to reveal the weak foundation of the entire germ theory by explaining the real causes for known diseases in my new series that exclude any mention of a virus, bacterium, or other supposed germ, for these diseases have causes that are known for causing a great deal of harm, often so much so that no supposed germ is even needed, because it is so obvious. And my intent is to acknowledge these causes and to substantiate their significance over any contagion, so that you can apply the principle of Occam's razor and see the truth for yourself. So what exactly is this disease called AIDS? AIDS stands for Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome, and it is in fact not a single disease. It is a conglomerate, meaning a category of various diseases that pre-exist at the start of the AIDS phenomenon. The CDC definition of AIDS is circular. It involves a list of 24 to 29 diseases, depending on the year, about 60% of which have to do with immunodeficiency, including tuberculosis, and 40% have to do with other types of diseases. some of which are of cancer type, such as cervical cancer, included in 1992 and 1993, and Kaposi sarcoma. The CDC calls these diseases AIDS only when antibodies against HIV are confirmed or presumed to be present. However, if a person tests HIV negative, then the diseases are given another name, so they would simply have Kaposi sarcoma or tuberculosis, for example. But if they were to test positive, they are declared to be an AIDS patient. Statistics based on such a definition are very misleading, because the definition assumes the correlation. Now let's look at the main tests that quote confirm the presence of HIV, which would turn any of the regular diseases we just mentioned into AIDS. These are PCR viral load tests, antibody tests, and CD4 cell counts. These tests are what you might call a surrogate marker. What is a surrogate marker, you might ask? Allow me to explain it in the context of pulmonary embolism. An embolus is a blockage of a vein or artery, so a blood vessel that is blocked, usually by a blood clot. A blood clot is blood that has hardened, and in the case of pulmonary emboli, you have a blood clot that blocks the artery of your lungs. So this can of course be very fatal, and a diagnosis must be made quickly. Symptoms of pulmonary emboli are primarily chest pain and dyspnea, which is a shortness of breath. Thus, pulmonary emboli can come across as a heart attack or pneumonia, because they share similar symptoms that call for different treatments, so the diagnosis must be made accurately. Fortunately, there is a test for this, and it is called an angiogram. Angiography involves inserting a guide wire into the artery and inserting a small flexible hollow tube along this guide wire. This tube is called a catheter. Then the radiologist injects a dye into the artery. If a clot is present, the angiogram reliably and accurately demonstrates its presence to the radiologist on the real-time X-ray. With this test, referred to as the gold standard, one can confidently say whether or not the patient has an embolus. As aptly explained by Dr. Tom Cowan in his book, The Contagion Myth, performing an angiogram is technically quite challenging. It requires a lot of time and equipment, so it is also quite expensive. It is dangerous, as the artery may tear during the insertion of the catheter. Another problem with angiography is that it requires the procedure of injecting dyes into the artery, and the patient might not react well to that. Finally, a solution was devised, the introduction of a surrogate test called the pulmonary ventilation perfusion scan, or the VQ scan, which is said to make it easier and safer to detect if someone has pulmonary emboli. The VQ scan looks at blood flow into and through the lungs, and compares this with air movements into and through the lungs. When all is well with the lungs, these two parameters match up. When an embolus is present, they usually don't match up, because blood flow is compromised. This allows the diagnostician to surmise that even though they have not actually seen a clot, it is likely to be present. A surrogate test is one that does not look for what you need to find, but rather for something likely to be there if the condition is present, so something that represents the thing you look for. To validate a surrogate test, which in this case is the VQ scan, one must first do a careful study in which the surrogate test is compared to the gold standard test, which is angiography in this case. The researchers begin by finding a large number of patients, let's say 2,000 patients, with symptoms typical of pulmonary emboli. Let's say that 1,000 do have an embolus as demonstrated with an angiogram, the gold standard test, whereas the other 1,000 do not. Now we have a group of people who either have or don't have the condition we are testing for. Then we do a VQ scan on each of the 2,000 patients. In the group that we know has an embolus, if 900 are positive on the VQ scan, then we know that the surrogate test picks up the diagnosis 90% of the time. In the other 10%, for whatever reason, the surrogate test fails to demonstrate the emboli, even though we know it's there. We now know that the false negative rate is 10%. This allows the clinician to forego the more difficult angiogram because they know how likely the VQ scan will be able to pick up the embolus if it is there. They also know that in the event that the test is negative, they still have a 10% chance the test missed it. In that case, they might want to move to the angiogram, if the level of suspicion is high that the patient does in fact have an embolus, in spite of the negative result on the VQ scan. This is basically the art of modern medicine. Likewise, the researchers can then take the 1,000 people who test negative on the angiogram, do a VQ scan on all of them, and determine the false positive rate. If 100 subjects test positive on the VQ scan, even though you know for sure they have no clot, then you can accurately and confidently say that for whatever reason, 10% of the time, the VQ scan is saying you have a clot when you don't. This helps the clinician who may be confronted with a patient whom he is pretty sure doesn't have a clot. For example, they may have evidence of pneumonia or a heart attack, but orders a VQ scan anyway. If the VQ scan is positive, they may want to confirm this by moving on to the angiogram, because they know that in 10% of the cases, the VQ scan is falsely positive. Clearly, the lower number of false positives and false negatives, the better and more reliable is the test. The point is, without having a gold standard test with which to compare your surrogate tests, and without this comparison having been performed in the clearest and most meticulous way possible, there is no possibility of having an accurate surrogate test. Thusly, it is completely pointless. If you've seen my video about viruses, you will know that such a gold standard does and probably will not exist for the aforementioned surrogate tests. What you usually get is a good old appeal to ignorance, which is a logical fallacy. Argumentum ad ignorantium. What we have to hold in mind is that the onus of proof is always on him or her who makes an assertion or proposes a theory. Now, you have two people or two fractions of people. One fraction is called the negative and the other fraction is called the positive. The positive is the one who makes a claim or assertion. The negative is the one who declines the assertion or claim. But we are talking about a mere assertion still, nothing has been proven yet. The onus of proof is on the one whom asserts the positive. If something is or did not happen, how can it be proven? Therefore, the negative always holds the field in logic, which is why critical thinking is paramount. If nothing has been proven, it is simply not wise to just take the assertion at face value. It has to be questioned until it is proven or disproven. So you could look at it as, it is not my job to prove the falsehood of my opponent's claim. It is the job of the opponent to prove the truth of his or her own claim. So picture someone saying that they see a cat in their corner over there. And I literally can't see the cat. There is no cat. And the person says, well, I do see it, and you have to believe me, otherwise you have to disprove my assertion. Prove to me that the cat isn't there. And the same goes for the theory that, quote, viruses cause disease. They say that I must believe them, otherwise prove that, quote, viruses don't cause disease. When the onus is on the one who proposes a theory, they have to prove that those artifacts can induce severe illness. Simply making the claim that cells break down into millions of particles in a poisoned rotten tissue sample does not constitute proof that the same would happen in my living system, within my living body. There is a huge difference between in vivo and in vitro. And inventing surrogate markers that find something other than what you say is the cause, which, as I've alluded to previously, finds a representation of the thing and not the actual thing itself, which is what all the tests do. That is why they are called surrogate markers. Surrogate as in replacement, or something that replaces something else. So instead of finding a quote virus, they try to find antibodies or genetic sequences, count CD4 cells, etc. The antibody test doesn't detect an antigen, the quote virus, they detect antibodies which are associated with the antigen, which are assumed to be proteins of the quote virus. And herein lies the aberration, because first they say that the presence of antibodies is good and an indication of protection from disease in the case of vaccination. And in this case, they say that antibodies are an indication of the disease itself. So there are obvious inconsistencies present in the theory. So what were they picking up if not for a quote virus? In the mid-1980s, the proteins which caused the tests to react most strongly were selected from blood samples from seriously ill AIDS patients and used to calibrate the tests. That these proteins have something to do with HIV has, however, never been proven. According to the theory, T helper cells are a type of white blood cells with surface receptors called CD4 molecules. They are commonly known as CD4 plus T helper cells. Hereinafter, I refer to them as CD4 cells. They claim that a CD4 count below a certain standard count can also be an indication of HIV. The WHO claims that a CD4 cell count below 350 CD4 cells, that you don't have enough of this white blood cell, means you have HIV and must be treated with AIDS medication. Surprisingly, here's a study from the Journal of Infectious Diseases stating that there were, quote, HIV negatives, according to the antibody test, that had fewer than 350 CD4 cells. So you can see that there is no rapport between these surrogate tests at all. And again, more logical inconsistencies. Gary Knoll, an American doctor, also shared his remarks. I took a group of marathon runners who were terribly healthy, never had any risk factors at all, vegetarian, and they were running a marathon. All of their CD4 cells were very low. In fact, so low, even though they were totally healthy getting ready for the marathon, had they gone in with any kind of experience of a symptom and someone measured their blood, they would have said, oh, you're a candidate for AIDS. It is no different with PCR, the polymerase chain reaction, which is used to track down genetic sequences and then replicate them a millionfold. Even the inventor of the method was very critical of the medical establishment's biased preference towards the thesis that a quote virus was the culprit.
Is not exact at all. It's not as good as our measurement for things like apples. An apple is an apple. You know, you can get something that's kind of like, if you got enough things that look kind of like an apple and you stick them all together, you might think it's an apple. But and HIV is like that. Those tests are all based on things that are invisible, and the results are inferred in a sense. PCR is separate from that. It's just a process that's used to make a whole lot of something out of something. That's what
also,
it is. It doesn't tell you that you're sick, and it doesn't tell you that the thing you ended up with really was going to hurt you or anything like that. That's why it's not.
I will discuss the PCR method more thoroughly in a specific video, because I find that it deserves a lot more attention. Now, what was the true cause of AIDS if not for a quote virus? The most prominent diseases that were classified under the conglomerate called AIDS were Kaposi sarcoma and PCP, which stands for Pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, and I reckon it's called Pneumocystis jirovecii now. The origins of the AIDS story officially began in 1981, with five young gay men who were found to have a mysterious condition. These five gentlemen were then brought together by Michael Gottlieb of the Medical Center of the University of California. Now, these five gentlemen all had PCP, a lung condition. But what they found so remarkable is that they were all around 30 years of age. And this condition mostly occurs in fairly old people, and babies with a, quote, immune defect. And I refrain from calling it that because it is in fact a cleansing defect, as we will see later on. The same goes for people on medications that interfere with our cleansing process. Randy Schultz, who has aptly researched this topic, writes in his book, And the Band Played On, he also knew it would be good to get out a medical journal report on this before anyone else did. He called the nation's most prestigious journal, the New England Journal of Medicine, and talked to an associate editor. I've got something here that is bigger than legionnaires, he said. What is the shortest time between submission and publication? Dr. Peter Duisberg, who has also researched the AIDS phenomenon very thoroughly, writes in his book Inventing the AIDS Virus, Gottlieb knew precisely what this discovery could mean for his career. However, the journal refused to bend traditional rules of publication. Frustrated and impatient, Gottlieb turned again to Wayne Shendera, who contacted the CDC. He figured this was probably the sort of outbreak that the CDC would be only too happy to publicize without delay. The article that was mentioned states the following. The diagnosis of pneumocystis pneumonia was confirmed for all five patients antemortem by closed or open lung biopsy. The patients did not know each other and had no known common contacts or knowledge of sexual partners who had had similar illnesses. Two of the five reported having frequent homosexual contact with various partners. All five reported using inhalant drugs, and one reported parenteral drug abuse. Antemortem refers to before their death, and a biopsy is the removal and examination of a tissue sample from a living body for diagnostic purposes. An open biopsy is referring to a more serious instance and takes place in the operating room where the patient is under influence of general anesthesia, because in this case a piece of tissue is being surgically removed, whereas a closed biopsy refers to a less severe instance, with the patient being under influence of local anesthesia, whereby a tissue sample is removed through a needle that is inserted at the area of suspicion with the aid of CT and fluoroscopy images. Parenteral drugs are drugs that are taken into the body or administered in a manner other than through the digestive tract, as by intravenous, meaning through the blood vessel, with heroin for example, or intramuscular injection, which means through the muscle. So just to briefly summarize, all five gentlemen had a lung disease. They did not know each other and did not know anyone who knew the other gentleman, so they did not have the same acquaintances. And they did not know anyone who had the same condition as them. The minority was more of a loose cannon in the sense that they had frequent sex with others, and all five used inhalant drugs, and one of them might have been using heroin or some other kind of drug you don't take in by mouth. Well, this revealed two things. It is claimed that this condition was sexually transmitted, but this article clearly explains that the patients did not know each other at all. Nor did they know anyone with the same condition. So the assumption that this mysterious condition, which at present was only known to these five gentlemen, was handed over to them when they didn't know each other, and didn't know the same people, and didn't know anyone else with the same condition, is completely illogical, because they were complete strangers to each other, especially when we see what really got them into this condition. And that's what we're going to talk about now. The inhalants used by these gentlemen were very popular within the gay community at the time, and they were called nitrite inhalants. Generally, they were known as poppers. Poppers are snorted from a small bottle, which looks like this. Hence the use of the word inhalant. For the people who don't know what they were used for, I will explain it as ceremoniously as possible. The reason gay men mainly used poppers is because it induces vasodilation. So it acts as a muscle relaxant, thus giving the passive partner in the relationship the opportunity to relax the sphincter muscles of the anus during sexual intercourse, which is why they were used so frequently by homosexual gentlemen and people who wanted to be less anal retentive. And poppers were not only used for this purpose, they were also used for the purpose of prolonging erection and orgasm, and they were also used as an aphrodisiac, which is an agent that stimulates libido. Well, it all sounds very gratifying, but the downside is that it's extremely toxic, especially to the lungs, because it hinders the ability of the blood to carry oxygen. And what is the first area to sustain the damage from the lack of oxygen? The linings of the blood vessels, otherwise known as the endothelium. Therefore, when the damage worsens, it becomes Kaposi sarcoma, a vascular tumor. Or a tumor of the blood vessels. We now know that poppers are harmful, so again, how are poppers taken in? By inhalation, which involves the lungs. So when the poisonous and harmful poppers are inhaled, it creates damaged material in our lungs. And because the body's cleansing mechanism is weakened, The fungi, the cavalry, the lifesavers come to clean up and restore the damage, because this is precisely their purpose, eating dead organic material. And this is why so many AIDS patients have PCP, because it has been claimed that PCP is caused by fungi. But as we now know, the fungi are not the cause merely because they are found at the site of the condition, the same way firefighters can be found at the site of fire. Similarly, they come to clean up the damage the person has caused by inhaling poisonous poppers drugs. So to come back to the article, all five men were homosexual. All five men used inhalant drugs, inhalant as in inhalation, inhalation as in lungs, and all five subsequently developed lung disease. It seems clear and obvious to me how these conditions really gained their constellation. So I pick Occam's razor. The widespread use of poppers started as early as 1963. Let's not forget one thing. From the 60s and 70s on, the period of the fast lane lifestyle began, i.e. general drug use in industrialized countries such as the US and over Europe massively began to rise after the 60s and 70s. During that same time, the number of cocaine overdose victims admitted to hospitals also exploded, from slightly more than 3,000 in 1981 to more than 120,000 in 1993, a 4,000% jump. And direct cocaine-related deaths increased more than tenfold from 1980 to 1990. And the list of drugs goes on. Poppers were also massively promoted with various commercials. And so in these kinds of commercials and magazines, poppers were advertised as something that makes you stronger, and that every gay man simply needs to have them. A clear case of an appeal to emotion. The sales of poppers amounted to an estimated total of $50 million a year. And this is why the correlation between Kaposi's sarcoma and poppers was so blatantly omnipresent. The pattern was nearly unavoidable, of how the people with these conditions were limited to those who lived the fast lane lifestyle, i.e. drug abusers, and why it was mainly gay men who developed this condition. Even our beloved Bobby Gallo admitted that poppers could be the primary cause of Kaposi's sarcoma. Now, why were they so biased and focused primarily on the virus? American journalist Celia Farber made that case clear with Gallo. Gallo stands to make a lot of money from patent rights on this virus. His entire reputation depends on the virus. If HIV is not the cause of AIDS, there is nothing left for Gallo. It would be very embarrassing to say that now, maybe the antibody test wasn't worth committing suicide for or burning houses for. And the profits they've made from the antiviral drugs, it won't surprise you why they opted for the virus theory. Something I would like to emphasize is that AIDS is not a sexually transmissible disease. We've seen that a lot of drugs were used, especially during sexual intercourse, during parties, etc. All night long they go wild on poppers, cocaine and the other list of drugs. And for the people who say, but what about the people who have not used any drugs, not even during sex? Well, for example, when someone has had a one-night stand with someone, often someone they didn't know, people will get tested out of fear of having acquired AIDS. And if the useless test does ping, it is immediately assumed that the person in question has acquired AIDS, while there was in fact nothing wrong with that person. And the reason why some people eventually did end up feeling worse is something we're going to talk about now. Enter AZT, an abbreviation for azathioprine. This was the first authorized AIDS medication in 1987, and then it was usually only one drug that patients received. But this changed in 1995 with the introduction of HART, which is an initialism for highly active antiretroviral therapy. And then the confetti broke out with this new breakthrough, with claims that these drugs would extend the lifetime of AIDS patients. It was said that this would increase the lifespan by 10 to 15 years. But this is very unfounded, because people taking this medication had an average survival rate of about 4 months in 1988. And in 1997, it became about 24 months. And this was mainly due to the adjustment of the dosage at the beginning of the 1990s. In about 1988, it was 1500 milligrams, and it was reduced to 500 milligrams, because it was also quite clear to orthodox medicine that higher dosages led to more deaths. What was so intriguing was that the vast majority of HIV positives are long-term survivors. Worldwide, they number 17 million, including 1 million HIV positive but healthy Americans, and 0.5 million HIV positive but healthy Europeans. Most of these have been HIV positive for at least 10 years now, unlike people on AIDS medications who only survived 4 to 24 months. Well, why would that be? The findings show that HAART treatment, since its introduction, has led to no sustained improvement in CD4 values, no reduction in AIDS-defining diseases, and no reduction in mortality rates, but that it has resulted in cardiovascular diseases, lipodystrophy, lactic acidosis, liver and kidney failures, osteoporosis, thyroid dysfunctions, neuropathy, Parkinson's disease, and non-AIDS-specific classes of cancer. Lipodystrophy is referring to an abnormality in the way the body processes or metabolizes fat. Lactic acidosis is a condition where there is an abnormality in the way our body processes lactic acid. So when you go to the gym and do a drop set of bicep curls, let's say you start with two 45-pound plates on each side, and you drop down to 225s, and then down to 210s, and you finish off whatever you have left with an empty bar. Usually you can do like 50 repetitions with an empty bar, but after doing that drop set, you can barely even do 10. Your arms just won't allow you to. That's because of lactic acid buildup. This is normal. But with lactic acidosis, there is an abnormality, and there is an accumulation of lactic acid in the body. This causes a person to develop muscle weakness, breathing problems, etc. Osteoporosis is a weakness in the bones, and in this case, it is due to the drug's influence on the bone marrow, the tissue on the inside of your bones, as we'll see later. And neuropathy is another word for various nervous disorders. Now let's look at the study that got AZT approved, which is the Fischel study. Now the first thing I want to bring to people's attention are the vested interests. One of the funders of the study was Burroughs Wellcome, which is the old name for the notorious company GlaxoSmithKline. And this is the actual producer of AZT. So as we read this paper, we have to keep in mind that there is vested interest at stake, so the study might be biased. And it is, as we'll see. So there were two groups, the placebo group and the Virum group. To find out whether a product has any adverse or beneficial effects, scientists do what they call a placebo study. One group gets the real product, the AZT in this case, and the other group gets a kind of saline solution, which is the placebo. When the product has negative effects, this can be seen because the AZT group with the real product begins to experience physical complaints, and the group with the saline solution does not. And during the research on beneficial effects, you can see that the AZT group feels better or lives longer than the placebo group. This study was in fact already stopped after 4 months, which is very strange if you want to know whether this product extends the lifespan of the AIDS patients in this study. This is in fact far too short, especially when they claim that it can extend the lifespan by 10 to 15 years. The reason for this was because 19 participants from the placebo group and only one participant from the AZT group had died. Now for the fraudulent part of the study. This was a double-blinded study. In a single-blinded study, patients don't know if they have the placebo or the actual product, and the experimenters do. And in a double-blinded study, both the patients and experimenters don't know who got what. Hence the term double-blind. There is two fractions who are blinded. But this was in fact violated by the patients demanding that they get the AZT and not the placebo, and they got it. The pills were even analyzed to confirm that they were actually getting the AZT, because they were so fearful of dying. They relied heavily on the drug that wasn't proven to be safe yet. So much for an appeal to authority. And now comes the worst part. The AZT group eventually began to experience severe negative effects, as did the placebo group, of course. And 30 patients in the AZT group were kept alive through the remainder of the study by means of blood transfusions. And in the placebo group, this was only done with 5 patients. So you can see what kind of fraud was committed in this study, just to give the impression that this product was good and valid, so that the manufacturer, GlaxoSmithKline, could get it approved so that they could sell it. So you can see the corporate bias that has cost so many lives. Not such a benevolent industry after all. At the end, 80% of the participants died after 4 years. And after a while, all the participants had died. So again, the claims about the extension of the lifespan is far from true. The reason they all died so early was because AZT is extremely toxic. It is a chemotherapy-like drug that stops DNA replication, a DNA inhibitor. And where most of this kind of DNA replication takes place is in the bone marrow. And we saw before that these drugs could cause bone marrow death. These drugs were invented by a gentleman named Jerome Horwitz in the 1960s, with the aim of inventing a DNA inhibitor that could fight cancer. But all the mice he used in his experiments had died because it was just way too toxic. When the experiments had ended in a failure, so in a way had the first half of Horwitz's life. Disgusted, he turned on AZT. We dumped it on the junk pile. I didn't keep the notebooks. So worthless was AZT to Horwitz that he didn't even think it was worth patenting. And this was the drug that was prescribed to people who tested, quote, positive with a useless test, and had to pay $8,000 a year for it, and who eventually died from this poisonous drug, and then it was simply told that they had died of AIDS. If we look at a few prominent cases, Freddie Mercury, for example, from the British rock band Queen, had himself tested in the late 1980s, when the dose of AZT was still 1500 milligrams, and took his doctor's advice and started taking AZT. He eventually passed away shortly after in 1991, not because he had died of AIDS, but because he was taking this toxic medication. An interesting case is that of basketball player Irvin Johnson, who was nicknamed Magic. He tested positive in 1991 and took the advice of his personal doctor David Ho, the AIDS researcher in New York, and Anthony Fauci. He then started taking AZT, but it eventually made him sicker. He had to vomit every day, and eventually he stopped taking the AZT. And in 1995, he finally admitted that he only took the AZT for a short time after it started making him sick. He then appropriately stated that there is no magic in AZT and no AZT in magic. AZT is just one antiretroviral drug among ganciclovir, acyclovir, zelcitabine, stavudine, nevirapine, and others, which all share the same hazardous potential. It was conjectured that there would be millions of deaths in Africa due to AIDS, and that there would be millions more. But these were mere computer-generated estimations that held no bearing on reality. I can show you. During the African AIDS epidemic, the sub-Saharan African population has grown at an annual rate of about 2-6% a year, from 378 million in 1980 to 652 million in 2000, according to the US Bureau of the Census International Database in 2001. Thus, Africa had gained since 1980 274 million people, the equivalent of the entire population of the US. Here, in the district of Kogera, population grew at 2.7% a year before 1988, only to accelerate to 3.1% even as the AIDS epidemic was supposedly peaking. Uganda's latest census tells a broadly similar story, as does South Africa's. Really? Botswana has just concluded a census that shows population growing at about 2.7% a year, in spite of what is usually described as the worst AIDS problem on the planet. Total population has risen to 1.7 million in just a decade. If anything, Botswana is experiencing a minor population explosion. There is similar bad news for the doomsayers in Tanzania's new census, which shows population growing at 2.9% a year. If we look at the living conditions in Africa, we can see here that young children obtain their water from a polluted waterhole. This is because more than half of the population in African countries does not have access to clean drinking water. The polluted water that the children drink here is sometimes very polluted with things like feces, heavy metals, etc. 4,500 children in Africa die every day because of the consumption of polluted water. And if our beloved medical establishment, which includes the WHO, really cared about the thing they ought to care about, health, they wouldn't have spent billions of dollars on their biased AIDS research that led nowhere except for the pockets of large corporations, but they would have been much better off improving access to clean drinking water in Africa. But instead, they thought, let us use these useless tests on people in Africa and sell them toxic AIDS drugs. People who aren't deprived of resources already and have little to no money to begin with. And the malice goes on. In 1986, the WHO introduced the Banjwe definition. According to this definition, anyone suffering from these symptoms was declared to be an AIDS patient, without the questionable blood tests and antibody tests. And this was how AIDS was also diagnosed in Africa. Now prepare yourself. The symptoms were weight loss, asthenia, which is a loss or lack of physical strength, and diarrhea. Well, that's not very hard to find in Africa, is it? Diarrhea from the horrible quality of the water there. Weight loss and weakness from the lack of food. And people were banned from villages because of these kinds of diagnoses. And instead of getting them what they need, food and clean drinking water, they were being frightened to death. They were told that they have a disease that requires their toxic treatments. They were being deprived. They were made even sicker and poorer. If this doesn't show you how the notion that higher-ups within the medical establishment have your health as their utmost priority is a load of bollocks, then quite frankly, I don't know what does. Neville Hodgkinson was a medical correspondent for the Sunday Times. He spent some weeks in Africa. When I asked people what disease they were dying of, they replied, from AIDS, whereupon I inquired, but from which disease in particular? To this they said, this patient has tuberculosis, that one chronic diarrhea, this one malaria, and that one leprosy. All diseases that have been known in Africa for ages. But then everything was re-diagnosed as AIDS out of fear of AIDS. This is just one classified condition. There are many more to discuss. The one thing that I want you to infer is how conditions of ill health have various causes to its inauguration. Simply put, we've been taught to look at disease in terms of labels and categories. We've been taught to look at things as being separate and unrelated, when things are much more interdependent than we think. We also see how authoritative bias has resulted in the obscuration of many obvious reasons for why people develop certain conditions. As we go through each condition, we will see this pattern emerge more frequently, and you will understand the true nature and illegitimacy of those who proclaim themselves as, quote, authorities over your health. And no longer will they be able to violate your volition, for you will understand that the power of health lies in your own hands, and not in any other. I thank you cordially. Till next time.